And there seems to be a bit of a problem with the news there, so let's start straight up with the BCFM Politics Show. Sorry, we had no news from Rupert Murdoch at 5 o'clock. We'll have to make some of our own, won't we? So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Horfield, Cabinet Member for Education and Skills, Claire Hiscott. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, scores of Russian athletes who've never tested positive for doping look to be banned from the Rio Olympics. When geopolitics takes over sport, is somebody preparing for world war? Also, last Friday night's coup attempt in Turkey, whether it was real or orchestrated, as very few people seem to know, but President Erdogan brings a new era of popular dictatorship to NATO and the Middle East. It's the end of the school year this week, but as US philosopher John Dewey said, education is a system of imposed ignorance. Well, he was saying it to make a point, but the teaching of how the world really works goes on at places like Rhodes College in Oxford, where people like US President Bill Clinton are paid for by Rhodes Scholars grants and fast-tracked into what you need to know over just 3 or 4 years. So, for the summer holidays, we pull away the curtain of some educational deception and encourage you to get beneath the surface of history as we examine the idea that the people who run the world aren't really the elected politicians, but the people that own the world and its media, banking and secret societies, the elite institutions. We look at the five big crime families whose ownership and control of the institutions of power has effectively turned the Western world, some say, into a silent dictatorship where the needs of ordinary people like you and I don't even register. And we ask, does the wealth and power of some of these families go back hundreds of years? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 22, sunny spells on Saturday, mainly cloudy though on Sunday. Again, it's time to ditch the shopping tomorrow and get out and enjoy the sun. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of sunshine this week, but also some showers around midweek. Next weekend is the 30th and 31st of July, highs of 21 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us this week to review the news is Conservative Councillor for Horfield and Cabinet Member for Education and Skills, Claire Hiscott. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good to be here on such a sunny evening.
Now, we've got a bit of a controversial topic in part two, which is criticising education, and you're part of Education and Skills on the Cabinet of the City Council. What do you make of, partly anyway, of what I was saying there, that some of what we learn is you need to dig a little bit deeper to find out what's really been going on in history and how the world really works?
Well, you always need to dig a bit deeper, and what's wonderful about Bristol is that now we're a learning city officially. We are the only UNESCO global learning city in England, which is fantastic. Is that actually I'm here now, it's a lovely job to promote lifelong learning, which is basically telling everybody to dig a bit deeper into what they're told and work out whether facts are really facts. And it's interesting that history is not always what's written in the history books.
No, it's written by the winners, isn't it, most of the time?
It often is.
Certainly when it comes to British colonialism and colonising of America, for example. But to the serious point, do you think it's fair to say that there are people that own our world, that run it more to a certain extent than some of the elected politicians?
I don't think anybody owns this world. Money obviously does tend to talk, as we're seeing with the Trump nomination. That's been money, and that's got him quite a lot of power so far. But at the end of the day, it is the people that decide. And in a civilised society, it will always be the people that decide. And I don't feel this country is run totally by an elite. It is run by its elected politicians. It's run, yes, in part by its businesses, but also it's run by its people who have very strong voices, as we saw a few weeks ago. They made a very strong statement, and fantastic democracy here in the UK, and it will always stay that
way.
Well,
look, let me give you an example. I think works the other way around is this whole Metro Mayor business, which now looks like it's going to happen. Effectively, that central government just bribing us, saying, well, we want this kind of way of organising government locally, we'll give you a bit more money if you do it the way we tell you. That's not really democracy, is it?
Well, we didn't have to take the offer, and North Somerset didn't take the offer, but sometimes you have to be pragmatic and decide what is good for your region. And actually, what is good for our region is working together on housing and infrastructure and skills. So actually, we like to work together across local authorities, and this gives us a bit of money to go ahead and do it. So actually, thanks very much, central government.
Well, the positive spin that the Bristol Post have put on it is that we're going to get a London-style public transport system, apparently, a new local authority.
Don't hold your breath there.
Sorry?
Don't hold your breath there.
Well,
for a new underground system, that's not going to...
I don't think it's going to be underground, but what they're saying, effectively, is that things like a kind of Bristol Oyster card.
Yep.
Business leaders were briefed on Friday morning, that is this morning, on plans being put together as part of the government's devolution deal, which Bristol, South Gloucestershire and Bath and North East Somerset have signed up for. The deal will see a new combined authority created next April and elections held in May for a metro-style mayor for the Bristol region. The new authority would have responsibility for planning and education as well as transport, which could see a major change in bus and public transport services in Bristol and the surrounding areas. Sounds like they're taking your portfolio.
No, they're not taking my portfolio. We will be working together very closely. We've already work with the local enterprise partnership and some skills monies coming down, and we'll work across the three authorities to work out where that skills budget really should go.
But I mean, it does seem a bit peculiar you doing this job being a Conservative in education skills, because so much of higher education, primary education, secondary education now has been ineffectively privatised. It's going out to the academy schools, which aren't under local authority control. So
it's not privatised. It's under the governance now of that board of governors. So it's much more local, and it gives the head of a school much more autonomy in deciding what's best for their pupils and their communities. So what we've seen in the last decade is Bristol schools really improve. Now, some of those schools have chosen to become academies. Nobody's forcing them to. Some have chosen that way forward, and some are still under local authority control. But you know what? And both are doing well. So I think the options are good.
Yes, I mean, for example, this school we're in now, City Academy, has spent a long time under special measures. It doesn't seem that this idea of private organisations and charities running schools rather than you at the local authorities really made any difference at all.
Well, if you think about it, about 20 years ago, I mean, we've been in Bristol for 18 years, and when I moved here, Bristol schools were third from bottom of the league tables, and they were not academised. We're looking at now, we're in the top quartile of achievement. We've come an awful long way, and some of those academies have made a big difference.
Martin, I suppose I should bring you in here as a teaching assistant, as well as your political head on as well. What do you make of this imposition of the Metro Mayor? Although I say it's an imposition, but in effectively this is something which Marvin and others have signed up to. And I wonder, I mean, this is just another question, if we're going to have more elections next year, beginning of next year, next April, whether George Ferguson might pop his head back up again and appear as our Metro Mayor.
Well, I have to say, this is the first I've heard of it. Perhaps it's because it's the end of term and I've been...
Well, it's this morning. It was announced this morning.
That's why I've only just heard. Well, not objection to it, but what I thought in the past was that there was too much political diversity within the region. And you're suggesting that North Somerset have opted out. Is that correct?
They have indeed.
So, in other words, that might suggest
but
that you've got
enough... But the door's still open if they'd like to come back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Bristol itself, we have an all-party cabinet, as you know. Whether that's feasible across the region is another matter.
Can I suggest that maybe the reason they've opted out is because they're Conservative and that the Metro Mayor may not be Conservative?
Well, I think it's hard to... I mean, I'm just trying to compute in my mind what the likely politics are of an organisation of that size, given the distribution of forces. I suppose what it means is that there will be everybody will have a reasonable chance of winning. So that's, in a sense, means that everybody can get behind it. It does make sense to have a regional government at that state, at that level.
But I mean, there was a vote about having a mayor in Bath recently, and they said no. So how come this is now being imposed on people, Claire?
It's not imposed on people at all. All the councils, all
the
councils
spoke, and they've done the opposite.
All the councils have debated whether this deal is going to be good for the region and good for working together. And I think people need to be very clear that a metro mayor doesn't control everything within the region. It has a very limited remit. It is about infrastructure, it's about housing, it's about skills. And we need to be very clear, it's not going to take over from your local authority. It has a very specific remit, so don't overestimate his power, his or her power.
I mean, this is something that I'm trying to think what they call Business West. I can remember when I was on the Cultural Development Partnership 10 years ago, probably even, they were talking about doing something like this, being in love with this idea of the old Avon area, and we're fed up with the fact that all the different local authorities in the region don't agree with each other enough, and this was something that Business West people like John Savage were talking about 10 years ago. They finally got their way.
Well, if you look across the country, Greater Manchester are really making a go of their devolution deal. They're sort of on deal 6 or 7 with central government. The Black Countries has also come together and around Birmingham and Solihull. And Birmingham and Solihull are politically poles apart at times, but they've worked out that actually working together is much better than fighting each other.
But I mean, I do get the impression that quite a lot of money has been taken away, Martin, from local authorities over, really, since the formation of the coalition government. And they're saying, well, you can have some of it back, but only if we have a centralisation of power.
Well, the other thing that's gone on is that lots of things are now not done by local authorities at all. At the same time, we've still got a democratic deficit at local level across Britain, which goes back to the 1980s and the struggles of that era, when Liverpool City Council refused to set a rate and were put into special measures and all the rest of it. And I don't think anybody wants to go back there. I think that the idea of having rational geographical scale for political institutions makes sense. I mean, a city is not doesn't stand on its own. It's got its environment around it and so on. But that makes it tricky politically. I think I imagine that North Somerset rather didn't fancy being run by some radical mayor based in Bristol, and they'd rather have Weston running its own show its own way.
There is a consultation going on about this, but it's only with businesses. None of the people who are living under this system are going to be asked.
No, you can go online. In fact, I went online Tuesday night, just after full council, and I filled in the survey of how I felt about the devolution deal. So can I just urge you, when you're Googling and surfing that web, just click on West of England devolution, and we are asking you what you want and what you think of things so far.
Your own favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Startpage is a good one.
Others are available.
It's right. Startpage is quite a good one in that it keeps your personal details anonymous rather than Google, that sees almost everything you type into them, or any mail or something to market with. The decision to have an elected mayor resulted in North Somerset opting out of the devolution deal. We've heard they're pressing ahead despite the political uncertainty. Dr. Greer, I'm trying to figure out who Dr. Greer is. Do you know who Dr. Greer is?
Your writing.
I'm sure it's here somewhere. He's pressing ahead with the devolution plans. I better find out who Dr. Greer is first, hadn't I, really? But Martin, this isn't really devolution, is it?
Well, I think the problem is that politicians, as you were suggesting in your introduction, at local level, at national level, don't necessarily decide everything that's going on. a lot of things are now run independent of local authority control. And so, you know, you're devolving. I mean, for example, we've now got an elected mayor in Bristol, and we've got to make £400 million worth of cuts dictated by central government. We don't control the business rate. Back in the day, you know, when Birmingham was revolutionised by having Chamberlain as its mayor in the 19th century, he could build things like a gas infrastructure and a water supply completely independent of national politics, funded through local taxation. That sort of devolution is long gone.
Okay, well, let's look at another story, a local story, before we go into some of the national stuff today, and that is to do with the 700 girls and women who've been mutilated over the last year in Bristol. Pretty horrible to hear this. Shocking new figures reveal 705 patients were treated for the effects of female genital mutilation in Bristol between April 2015 and March 2016. The new data marks the first time that FGM figures for England have ever been produced by the Health and Social Care Information Centre. Information collected from hospitals, mental health providers and GP practices reveal most of the victims aged between 25 and 34. Bristol has one of the highest rates of female genital mutilation in the country, experts believe. Now, this is pretty horrific stuff, Martin.
Well, it is. It is. And we're now becoming more and more aware of the scale of this problem. And, of course, it's got nothing to do with Islam at all, for example. You know, if people think this is some kind of Islamic practice, they would be wrong. It's a cultural practice that goes back long before Islam. And it's very difficult to change people's attitudes about things like this, because I presume in the communities concerned that girls that don't have it done are seen as somehow not properly, you know, grown up, you know, they can't be married and so on and so forth. And changing those attitudes has to happen, but it's going to take a long time.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, which seems like a crazy thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, what about Jewish male circumcision? Isn't that
there
similar?
Is an issue there as well. I mean, if you're going to ban female circumcision, I would argue that you should also say that if you're an adult, if you're 16 years old and you decide you want to have your genitals mutilated part of a religious rite, I mean, people have all sorts of silly tattoos and things and dye their hair all sorts of funny colours, but for a child under the age of consent, I think there really is an issue in any community.
But that's not the case, is it? Hang on, because that's not the case, because most of the victims are aged between 25 and 34.
For FGM?
Yeah.
Well, that shocks me, because I'm surprised.
I haven't read
the article properly.
This is Emma Grimshaw's article in The Post. I wonder what you make of this. Mm. It's not very good accolade for Bristol, is it, to be one of the highest numbers of FGM
in the country? What I would say is that we've done huge amounts of work in the past few years. I want to take my hat off, really, to the work of Integrate, and particularly Farmer Mohammed, who's just got an honorary doctorate from the University of Bristol, for her work in raising awareness of FGM. And it really is about cultural change, and it's about understanding. And actually, the fact that we are now talking about it on radio and discussing it, and the schools are aware of the issues, looking into, you know, it's all credit to charities that have been working in that sector to raise the issue. Because, you know, so a few years ago, this was all brushed under the carpet and nobody wanted to talk about it. It's now a topic for discussion, and that is when you move forward. And yes, the figures are horrific and they are upsetting. But, you know, we are making huge progress within the city, within all cultures, about raising the issue. And particularly within schools, it's been great to see the work done informing teachers and board of governors to really look out for our young people, and to make young people, young girls who are worried and are concerned about perhaps going abroad and what might happen, is we're raising those issues. People are aware. There are people to go to now. These figures are upsetting. They are tragic. Every young girl that is mutilated against her will, you know, that is abuse, that is a crime, and I am very clear about it. But every one we save is a step forward. And I think it would be great if we could actually just mention the FGM helpline. If you feel that you are at risk or you know someone at risk, then please ring 0800 028 3550 and get in touch and get some help, because the only way that we fight this as a city is doing that together and talking about the issue and not brushing it under the carpet.
Yes, it's certainly not taboo on this channel. Anyone worried that a child is at risk can call the FGM helpline on 0800 028 3550, and I'll put that phone number on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Now, moving on to some of the massive shifting tectonic plates in the national political scene. Firstly, with you, Claire, and the Conservative Party, it really doesn't seem to me democratic to have Theresa May appointed as the new Prime Minister without any kind of election, proper election of the... You've got 150,000 paid-up members in the Conservative Party, and yet they've not been asked. I mean, it does look as if the Murdoch press 2 weeks ago effectively bullied Andrea Leadsom out of the contest and gave her a pasting. And so Theresa May has been put into power uncontested.
Well, let's be really clear about the UK democratic process. You do not vote for a prime minister. You vote for a candidate within your constituency who is often from a political party. The largest party represented can put forward a person to become Prime Minister to run Her Majesty's government. You never vote for a Prime Minister.
Yeah, but here's the question. If last year Theresa May had been the leader of the Conservative Party...
She'd have won as just as well.
You think
as
she would?
Cameron.
Because
absolutely.
I don't think so at all.
Well, I think, you see, what happens in a democracy...
It's just a difference of opinion, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yes, but what happens in a democracy
is people
is that
vote.
You put forward a manifesto. You put forward a range of policies, and you, as the electorate, you vote on those policies. Don't vote for the person... Vote for the policies. That's what's really important. You know, politics isn't a game of celebrity. You know, it's being made to be that, but it isn't. It's about policy, it's about getting the job done, and it's about, you know, making that choice. And Theresa May is sticking to a lot of that manifesto. And, you know, let's be very clear, you don't vote for a prime minister, you vote for a party.
She was effectively a kind of, well, I don't know, I think stalking horse isn't quite the right word, but the idea that you're going to have all these discussions amongst MPs, votes amongst MPs, to have two candidates to then put to the membership, the 150,000 members of the Tory party,
yep.
And then one will just say, OK, I'm leaving the stage now. It does sound like...
Andrea's decision.
Well, yes, I know, but it sounds like she's thrown the fight.
No, she didn't. Not at all. She made a decision to stand for leader of the party, and she decided after consideration and a while to withdraw from that. Just as, you know, Chukwuemeka a year or so ago threw his hat in the ring for the Labour Party membership and then changed his mind after a few days without, you know, getting very far.
We've seen a very different thing going on in the Labour Party.
in fact, a contest
that didn't really need to happen. But what's your view on the whole David Cameron stepping down after the Brexit referendum? Because a lot of people said to him, well, you know, you're criticising everybody else for not being a fighter, and then you're just bowing out as soon as the referendum's happened.
Well, David Cameron was very clear that he really supported Remain, and I think he felt that he put everything behind that campaign to remain within the EU, and the country decided that they did not agree with him. Now, yes, he could have stayed on, but then, you know, he is a man of principle, and he felt that actually if the country is not behind him and he couldn't convince them to remain within the EU, then it was probably time to let somebody else take over. And I thought that was very dignified, that was very honourable. It certainly wasn't holding on to power like Jeremy Corbyn is at the moment, not listening to his MPs. You know, David Cameron, he did the decent thing, he did an honourable thing, he stepped down, he's been been, you know, just not made any comments about new leaders. We've got on, had a leadership election. We've got Theresa May in power. She's already storming forward. And if the Labour Party could get on with it too, that would be great.
Well, she managed to just about get through the first Prime Minister's questions. She hasn't got to worry about that for a few months. Martin, the problem, I think, mostly with Theresa May seems to be her husband, who's a senior executive at a $1.4 trillion investment fund that profits from tax avoiding companies. This is in the Independent last week, actually. Philip John May, his portfolio of his company Capital Group also includes 20 billion of shares in Amazon and Starbucks, both of which were cited by the Prime Minister designate in her pledge to crack down on tax avoidance. This is last week. Latest filings to US authorities show Los Angeles based Capital Group owns a huge stake in companies including JP Morgan Chase, we'll be hearing about those in the second hour, defence giant Lockheed Martin, tobacco company Philip Morris, and the pharmaceutical sector's Merck & Co., also in Ryanair.
Well, I think obviously anybody that was chosen to be Tory leader might turn out to have such links. That's one of the things about the leadership of the Tory party.
Or Labour leader. Why not?
Well, or some of the Labour people.
Have links. I think you need to be very careful.
On the board. John Major's
say.
On the board of what's the name of the company?
The Carlyle Group.
But not then.
Yeah, he was afterwards.
I mean, what's happened with Tony Blair is you know, he's just become a multi-millionaire on the back of being PM.
And Labour.
It seems that this big business world, Claire, does cast a shadow over the integrity of our politicians, don't you think?
I don't think it casts a shadow. You know, we have to get real. There are big businesses out there. This is a big planet. There are going to be big businesses. But big businesses employ lots of people. And that keeps people in their homes, raising their families. So don't knock the big businesses out there, as long as they pay their taxes, pay their dues,
And
they act fairly. Well, that's what we've got to crack
Amazon
down
and
on.
Starbucks. We've
cracked down a lot on Amazon and Starbucks already, and I think we've done a lot more than the Labour Party before us. In those six years,
the opposite is happening.
Progress.
I mean, what's happening is we are begging them to stay in Britain. We're cutting corporation tax, and we're saying, please, please, please don't go away. We'll do anything for you.
This is a global market, and you have to be competitive, and there's absolutely no shame in that. If we want to do the right thing by this nation, we do have to be competitive. We have to be fair. But we have to be competitive. And actually, they are not running away. People are absolutely here to stay. They are investing in the UK. Nobody's got up and left yet. And I'm not hearing it either.
The other company that Capital Group have got a $5 billion stake in is McDonald's.
Well, I mean,
well, they could go, actually.
Well, the inevitable. I mean, there is a bigger issue here, which is the relationship between money and politics. I mean, if we've seen in the US... The decision by the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, which allows anybody to spend any amount on an election, and you're not even allowed to know who's spending the money. It really is just anybody
can
check.
And that is why we're a lot more transparent and
we're more transparent. Well, we're in a halfway house. If you go to countries like Norway or Denmark, after the war, they instituted basically state-funded political parties, so that political parties are funded by the government according to their support at the last election.
Is that a good use of taxpayers' money?
Well, it's the problem. If you're going to have a democracy, you've got to pay to have it. Somebody's got to pay to have it. Yeah.
Well,
elections are expensive.
I think voluntary donations are the way to go.
Well, let me tell you a story.
I wouldn't be giving money to.
When I was working with the Polish Socialist Party in Poland in the 1990s, they were struggling to find money. Of course, as political parties do, they were an old party in Poland. They'd been there for many years before the war, but they were found. You know, politics costs money. You know it. You need leaflets.
It does.
Phone calls. You need. You know. And we had to go for a meeting with these Austrian businessmen in a hotel in Warsaw to try and get some money for the local election. And we went in, and we were in government at the time, or we were part of the government, and we were able to argue with them. Piotr Ikonowicz, who was the MP I was with, they said, right, we can fix you a meeting with the minister on Monday so that you can get a quick decision on this hotel that you want to build. So we agreed it, and then they said, right, but we've got the local elections coming up. We said, oh, yes, of course, and you want a donation. And we said, yes. That'd be right. And they said, so who do we make this payable to? you personally or the Polish Socialist Party? And we said, Polish Socialist Party, please. So we then got the money.
So are you saying you promised them a hotel?
Well, we promised them a quick meeting with the minister.
To butter them up?
Well, we promised them a quick meeting with the minister.
Is that really a way to run politics?
That sounds like, sounds to me, Martin.
We haven't finished.
It sounds like cash for questions.
When we finished that, they then said to us, once the hotel's built, you can have your conferences there and we will fix girls for you and anything you like. And at that point, we took our cheque and left.
Good.
But that's the reality of politics around the world, not just in Poland, everywhere. It costs money. There's no honesty about this in this country. It does make a difference. It does mean to lead to situations where Michael Liebman, whatever his name is, who's a Labour donor, is now suing us because he doesn't like the decisions that have been taken by the NEC and so on. Money matters in politics. It certainly does. And it's dirty all over the world. Dirty here as everywhere else.
So, I mean, we'll have some sort of declaration of interest, obviously, from Theresa May, but the real interest is in what's her husband's interest.
Well, her husband doesn't own that company, let's just be clear. And he is a relationship manager with companies. He is advisor.
It's going to make that relationship a lot easier, isn't it? It's going to make that relationship with those companies a lot easier, having his wife as the Prime Minister of Britain.
If there was any question over that, we'd have dug it up already. Theresa's been in government for a long time. She's been around for a long time. And I think you'll find that actually there is
several of the national papers have dug up all sorts of interesting things to do with tax evasion of some of these firms.
And
I'll put links on those. I'll put links to those articles on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Now over to you, Martin. I think it's time for you to explain what's been going on in the Labour Party, because I've got the omerta from the three local Labour MPs over the last 3 weeks. Been trying desperately to get one of them at least to come on and explain what's going on. So maybe you can help us out. We've had literally just a week ago, it was going to be Angela Eagle taking on Jeremy Corbyn. Now it's this guy, Owen Smith. Who is he?
Well, hardly anybody knows, which is one of the problems he's got. I mean, he's going to have
I'll tell you who he is. He's a broadcaster whose dad was running BBC Wales.
Out there in the wider world, he hasn't got much name recognition. Obviously, he will get coverage as we have the contest over the summer.
Well, let me tell you, because we've just been talking about tax avoidance from Amazon and people like that, Owen Smith accepted a £60,000 grant from industrial scale tax avoidance firm. This is Miles Goslett, report. A £60,000 donation was from an accountancy firm which has been accused of promoting tax avoidance on an industrial scale by his own party. Smith received the gift from city firm PricewaterhouseCoopers in November 2011 while serving as shadow treasury minister. It was a donation in kind for ad hoc services provided to Labour during the passage of the Finance Number 4 bill. Links with the Labour Party and PricewaterhouseCoopers were particularly strong at the time, with shadow cabinet ministers during the last parliament including Ed Balls, Chucka Amuna, Rachel Reeves, and accepting free advice worth hundreds of thousands of pounds from the company. Now, this is just the same game, isn't it?
Essentially, it is, and that's in a nutshell. That's what's going on in the.
We want our politicians to work for us, not for these businesses.
That's with their
checkbooks.
That's what those who will be voting for Jeremy Corbyn, and I shall be one of them, believe. And also, we need to reform the political system in this country. We probably need to change the electoral system to let everybody have a chance, including UKIP, who got 4 million votes at the last election and one MP. Sinn Féin got 4. Is that democracy?
Yes, and they don't get any representation hardly on the radio or the TV.
Democracy is always a work in progress, and it always will be. But the idea that it can't be improved, I think, is wrong. And I think that money in politics, as we've seen in the US, is incredibly destructive. And, of course, what's happened in the US is you've got escalating arms race in terms of the amount of money that's thrown at elections. Whereas elections in places like Norway are to budget every time, because there is only one budget and everybody knows what it is.
Yeah, so you certainly don't want to go down the route of the US. Anyway, to answer my own question, Owen Smith was a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry before he became an MP. But before we hear that, because Thangam Debonair, although she didn't want to come on this programme and I didn't get replies from her office this week, just a complete blank, basically, was on Channel 4 News this week. I think it was Monday or Tuesday evening, and so here she is being interviewed by Cathy Newman on Channel 4 News.
Thangam Debonair, who revealed in a detailed post on Facebook how she was offered a front bench job, then sacked from it the next day, all without being told, and while she was having treatment for cancer. Well, she joins me now. It's a curious story, this. What exactly happened?
Well, I'd been through chemotherapy and an operation, and I was starting radiotherapy on the 14th of January, and that afternoon I discovered, via journalists phoning my office, that somebody thought I was the arts, shadow arts and culture minister. Now, I didn't take their word for it. I phoned up the Labour Whip's office and discovered that, in fact, Jeremy Corbyn was supposed to have told me. He'd neither told me nor asked me. Now, that was fine. I decided, after some sort of consultation, that I would shoulder that and take it on. I mean, it wasn't the best timing. I could have really lived without it, but it was a role which I considered myself really well suited to. I have an arts background, and it was a good fit for my constituency, very arty, and I thought my members, Labour members, would be really happy that I was supporting Jeremy, and I wanted to serve. Now, that was tricky, but 6 weeks later, I discovered that actually the very next day, he'd actually given that job back to somebody else, the person who thought it was their job in the first place, and who had not unnaturally felt a little bit irked.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn's office says that's all entirely false, and that you were never sacked.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it, that they seem to be accusing me of being a liar. I mean, they press released that they'd appointed me. They know they didn't ask me first. They absolutely know this, as does Jeremy. And they also know that the very next day that the person who thought it was her job came and asked for it back again, not unreasonably. But nobody thought to tell me. Jeremy himself, in the end, had to tell me 6 weeks later, after weeks and weeks of people saying to him, you need to phone Thangam and let her know, because meanwhile, I'd been working on that role.
What does it say about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, do you think?
It says that communication isn't his strong point, I think, to say the least. And, you know, failure to make a very simple phone call. I mean, this is a really junior post, Cathy. I mean, what does it really matter, I suppose, to
many
people?
Maybe he's just a bit disorganised.
In charge of the Labour Party. We need someone who's going to be a Prime Minister in waiting. What this country really needs, especially after the disastrous referendum result, is someone who is a Prime Minister in waiting who's going to take us into a Labour government.
Well, so the Labour grassroots think that he is a Prime Minister in waiting, or at least they voted for him with a massive mandate.
Yeah.
Are you not being undemocratic in trying to remove him in this sort of coup?
I respect the fact that people felt really enlightened and inspired by Jeremy. And, you know, I share many of his beliefs. I too want a nationalised rail service. I too feel really strongly about some of the issues that he campaigns on. But that does not a leader make. Just having the majority of the votes doesn't mean that you're automatically leadership material. And what's marked out Jeremy's leadership, not just me, but many other people as well who are starting to speak out, is that he has a failure to speak to, listen to, communicate with, or even work with, on a very basic level, people on his front bench.
Well, it remains to be seen whether the grassroots agree with you or back Jeremy Corbyn again. If he is re-elected after all this leadership challenge performance, are you someone who might contemplate joining a breakaway party, splitting from the rest of the Labour Party?
No, I don't want to get into that because I'm Labour through and through. I want a Labour Party that's united, and that's why I'm really hoping that the party will get behind Angela Eagle to run against Jeremy Corbyn and to win. Because
but if she fails, would you just begrudgingly support Jeremy Corbyn?
I don't believe Angela's going to fail. I think she's going to do a fantastic job, and I believe that she's going to be the next leader of the Labour Party and the first Labour Prime Minister. And that's a big if, and I'm hoping that enough people have realised just how poor Jeremy's communication skills are and just how much that matters if you're really going to be the leader of Her Majesty's opposition.
Thangam Debonair, thank you very much for joining us.
And that was Cathy Newman interviewing local MP Thangam Debonair. None of the Labour MPs for Bristol, who I've all invited for the last 3 weeks onto this programme, have been able to make it for one reason or another. But Martin, this is a pretty damning indictment of Jeremy Corbyn, isn't it? I mean, disorganised is putting it mildly.
Well, I think Thangam's entitled to her view, and she's made it fairly clear what her view is. I think it's not the view of her constituency party, and I know because I'm a member of it.
Look, we're not talking about that. We're talking about whether he's actually got communication skills.
Don't forget.
She's the shadow arts and culture minister, but she was neither told nor asked whether she wanted to do the job.
Well, that I don't know the detail of that. That will have to come out in the wash one way or the other. The fact of the matter is that Jeremy Corbyn does communicate to a large number of people across the country who are potential Labour supporters.
But isn't it a good idea for him to communicate to his own shadow ministers?
Well, don't forget, there may well be a split in the Labour Party. Let's talk about splits in the Labour Party. There was a split in the Labour Party in New Zealand in the early 1980s.
Yes, you've said this several times, Martin. Look, Thangam is saying she's not interested in that.
Well, in that case, what could easily happen here is Jeremy Corbyn is going to be re-elected, and she's going to have to carry on being in the Labour Party with Jeremy as the leader. Although if there is further trouble, we may go down the road, the unions have already talked about this, of going back to deselection of people who don't represent the views. I actually didn't vote for Thangham to be the Labour candidate. I voted for Gemma, whose second name I've forgotten, because she was supported by the trade unions. And I'm pretty confident that Gemma, who would have just won just as good a majority as Thangham, because it's being a Labour Party member that wins you, not having a name of Thangham Debonair, it's the Thangham Debonair Labour that got her 15,000 majority. And I'm quite sure Gemma would have got exactly the same majority, but she wouldn't have done what all three of our Labour MPs.
What about the point that Cathy Newman is teased out there, and Thangham was saying about being sacked whilst she's undergoing cancer treatment? Now that sounds like bullying.
Well, look, this will have to come out in the wash. The fact is that both Kerry and Karen also are involved in this attempt to unseat Jeremy. This is about politics. The Labour Party is a broad church because of first past the post. It has to be. But of course...
But it's not a broad church, is it, if they're fighting each other?
No, yeah, but it's first past the post that forces this on us. In Germany, for example, you have the SPD and you have the Linkspartei. The Linkspartei get their 15% of the vote and the SPD get their 25% of the vote. And then, of course, you then form coalitions. That's what we've already formed coalitions in Bristol. We do it all the time. That's normal politics. The idea that everything has got... We were talking earlier about not having a presidential system. You vote for the party, not for the prime minister. That's absolutely right. And Jeremy Corbyn is primus inter pares in the Labour Party. And the rules of the Labour Party say that the membership... elect the leader. Now, that they are new rules. They are based on the American system of primaries, and it's the most modern, effective way of doing it. And we believe, those who support Jeremy Corbyn, and I'm one of them, I wasn't convinced at first, but I now am convinced.
So one minute you're saying we shouldn't do what the Americans do, and the next minute you're saying we should.
We go down the American road whether we like
it or not. Let's let Claire come in
here. If you look at Jeremy Corbyn's history within the Labour Party and as an MP, he is one of the most rebellious MPs ever. Always, always rebelling against the Labour Party whip, and he doesn't like it when it comes back to him. If you disagree with Jeremy now, you get bullied, you get threatened with deselection. Okay, and he's had a long run of being able to be a rebel and still remain within the Labour Party. Everybody was very tolerant of him, but he seems to be completely intolerant of anybody who seeks to question him.
Well, one point I would make, she has
acted with integrity.
One point to make from the Labour Party Central Office, as they say, at no point at all was Thangham ever sacked. So that's their point of view.
Was she ever appointed?
Well,
out of common courtesy, somebody should telephone ask. That is worrying. If it came to him not running a shadow cabinet, a real cabinet, do you think his ministers might like to know whether or not they've got a job or what it is they're doing?
Well, look, to be fair,
you cannot take those risks with people who can't pick up the phone.
Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Central Office were not in the studio. That was Thangham's point of view of Thangham's account of events. But anyway, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn were daggers drawn at Prime Minister's questions for the last one before the summer break. She managed to just squeeze in under the bar.
There are many members on the opposition benches who might be familiar with an unscrupulous boss. A boss who doesn't listen to his workers. A boss who requires some of his workers to double their workload. A boss... And maybe even a boss who exploits the rules to further his own career. Remind him of anybody.
Mr. Speaker, we are sent here to represent people. And there are many people in this country struggling with insecure jobs, with low wages. I know this is very funny for all Conservative members, but I do not suppose there's too many Conservative MPs who have to go to a food bank in order to supplement their family table every week. I think we should reflect on those things. The Prime Minister highlighted the failures of her predecessor on social justice, home ownership, education and the cost of living. Some might say that as a Cabinet Minister, she too was responsible for that. But she empathised with working people when she said, "I know you're working round the clock. I know you're doing your best. I know that sometimes life can be a struggle. Yesterday, the Institute of Fiscal Studies found that two-thirds of children living in poverty in Britain have at least one parent in work. What other than warm words is she going to offer those families, those children who are hungry often and very insecure in their living? Isn't it our duty to offer some hope and security to them?
Yes, it is, and we are concerned about those people. But the answer is not the Labour Party's answer of unlimited, uncapped welfare for people. The answer to people who are in work and who are struggling in work, and the answer to those people who want to get into work, is to have a strong economy, an economy that delivers jobs and that delivers well-paid jobs. And that's why I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman that on this side of the House, we are focused on building a country that works for everyone. That's an economy that ensures that everyone can benefit from the nation's wealth, a society where everyone gets the opportunities they deserve, and a democracy that everyone can have faith in. And finally, I'd just say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Labour Party may be about to spend several months of fighting and tearing itself apart. The Conservative Party will be spending those months bringing this country back together. Yeah!
Well, what can I say? Jeremy Corbyn obviously sticking to his pre-arranged agenda. Theresa May, I mean, she brought forward the Trident vote to try and intensify the debate within the Labour Party. There is two parties inside the Labour Party struggling to get out. We either split or we stay together. Now, in actual fact, there's a lot of history that keeps us together rather than splitting. Thangam is a personal friend of mine. If we disagree about this, I'm sure we'll carry on being.
But what about the issues, the basic issue that is she's bringing up? Hang on, Martin, we've got two-thirds of children. Let's just think about the actual facts that Jeremy Corbyn's bringing up there. Two-thirds of children now in poverty have got at least one parent that's working.
Well, let's come back to what Theresa May said, which is having a strong economy. We haven't got a strong economy. We've had zero interest rates for 8 years now. The quantitative easing is still happening but under the table all over the world. What's happened since the Brexit shock has been absorbed by central banks intervening yet again in the stock markets. This is actually bowling down the road to disaster. I'm not the only one who thinks so. The free market economists at the von Mises Institute, the people that used to advise the Reagan administration, David Stockman and Paul Craig Roberts, all of these people, they know, and I know as economists, that in actual fact what's been going on is essentially a hoodwinking of the people. You can't run capitalism on zero interest rates. It doesn't work like that. The hope is that eventually it'll kind of solve itself. But basically what we've been doing is we were in a car crash in 2008, we're still in intensive care, but we've been taking an awful lot of heroin.
Claire, what do you make of this contested point as to whether we are in a healthy economy or not? Because, I mean, one of the basic facts as we can see, if you look at the national debt, it's climbing at an incredible rate, about £200 billion pounds a year.
We've given up on the deficit now.
I mean, we're talking about, I think it's around about 1.5 trillion now, and it's just going up almost like a one in five hill, or one in two hill.
Yes, it is. But just to come back on interest rates, that is a global phenomenon at the moment, and we are not unique in that. But if you look at the economy as a whole, since Brexit, it all went wobbly. But if you look now, we're back to a FTSE 100, the same as it was before Brexit. We're looking at a FTSE 250, which is more reflective of UK businesses back to where it was before the Brexit vote. And we're also hearing from Melvyn King, former Bank of England guy, who said, you know, the pound did need to devalue a little bit because it makes our exports that much more competitive. You know, things go up and down, and they go up and down on a global scale. I mean, but we are still a strong economy that has created more jobs under a Conservative government than Labour did.
But those jobs are not paying the bills. That's the problem.
They are paying more of the bills than not having a job
at all.
But look,
Claire, look, this is a real basic point.
And I know people are struggling.
More and more people are on in-work benefits than ever.
They are. They are, and they are struggling. But you know what? That is because more people are actually in work instead out of work.
What happens when you're living in a country where work is no longer a way out of poverty? I mean, that's where we are now, isn't it?
Well, it really is something that we have got to continue working on. And I was absolutely delighted to see the House of Commons Scrutiny Commission having giving the leader of Sports Direct a real hard time about the way that he deals with his zero hours employees. And that is the job of government, to really get in and question bad practice, immoral practice, and that's what we've got to stamp out. You know, it'll always be the way that when there's growth, there are people that are the fair players and the unfair players. We've got to root out those guys, and we've got to champion fair salaries, fair wages for a fair hour's work.
Well, I totally,
and that is absolutely vital. And that's
totally
what we're
agree with you
to.
On that one, if that could ever happen. Anyway, let's just run through the Theresa May's new Tory cabinet quickly and see if there's anyone that jumps out to you, Claire, as someone particularly interesting.
I'm delighted to see Amber Rudd.
Well, I'll just run through them. Philip Hammond is the new Chancellor. Yep. George Osborne and his austerity, apparently that's out the window now. Amber Rudd as Home Secretary. Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary. Damian Green in work and pensions. Andrea Leadsom, who bowed out of the leadership contest, has been given Environment Secretary. Jeremy Hunt stays in Health. Justin Greening, Liam Fox, Justin Greening Education. I suppose that's quite close to your heart, Claire. Liam Fox, absolutely. International Trade, our local North Somerset MP, who was kicked out as Defence Secretary, actually had to force to resign in 2010 or 2011. I'm not quite sure which. Liam Fox, International Trade. Michael Fallon in Defence. Liz Truss in Justice. Karen Bradley, Culture Minister. David Davis is the new Brexit Secretary. Chris Grayling, Transport Secretary. Priti Patel, International Development, and the Department for Climate Change, which many people haven't even noticed, has been completely disbanded. Anyway, what would you make of any of those particularly you'd like to point out?
I'm delighted to see Amber Rudd promoted. She is a very capable woman, a very safe pair of hands. I've met her when she was Energy Secretary. She is a very diligent woman.
Former investment banker at JP Morgan.
Yes, so she knows her stuff. And she's a woman who really sees through her role. It's been really good to see some really hard working MPs put into the cabinet, because I think Theresa May's got a solid work ethic herself, and she'll want that out of her cabinet. Delighted to see Justine Greening in education as well, state educated, and she's going to be a real boon.
Martin? Any of these jump out to you?
I don't feel that I particularly want to comment, because none of these people would be people I would want to see in government if I was the Prime Minister.
What do you make of Boris Johnson's choice of Foreign Secretary?
Well, Boris Johnson you could say it's a brave decision, because he carries a lot of baggage. He's a brainy enough guy, but he's said an awful lot of silly things over the years, which is now possibly going to come back to haunt
him. And what about Liam Fox at International Trade? Because, you know, he's already had to resign. It sounds like the Conservative Party's answer to Peter Mandelson, who keeps bouncing back after being forced to resign.
Well, can I say the main problem that Theresa May is going to face is what kind of Brexit it's going to be. The City of London and many of the people like her who voted for Remain, and I was one of them, will probably want a Norwegian-style deal where we have to pay into the EU budget but we don't get anything out. We still have access to the single market, you've got to accept free movement of labour. It's been pretty clearly made to Theresa when she went to talk to Angela Merkel and François Hollande.
Okay, well, we've got hang on, Martin, because we've got two people who've done their leadership bids this week to become leader of the Labour Party. Let's have a listen just for half a minute or so to the opening of Owen Smith's first speech as part of his Labour leadership bid.
Colleagues, comrades, friends, I am so proud to be stood here before you today, so proud to be addressing you, launching my bid to be the next leader of the Labour Party, and more importantly than that, the next Labour Prime Minister of this country. You cannot imagine how the pride swells inside me seeing all of you here today and hearing the introductions from Kate and Abby. I'd like to start by thanking everybody for coming. I'd like to say, we knew we were meant to do this a few days ago, We didn't because of those terrible events in Nice. And on behalf of all of us here today and on behalf of the Labour movement, I'd like to send out our messages of condolences and fraternity and solidarity with the French people at this terrible time. But we are here to talk today about our future, about the future of the Labour Party. And I'm here to ask you to put your trust in me. I'm here in my hometown, the town that created me as a Labour man, the town that made me the politician that I am, the man that I am, and the leader that I would be if I succeed in my task in the next few weeks.
Well, he's starting off by saying he's going to be the next Labour leader, but then he seems a little bit not so sure, a little bit further down the line. But anyway, the fact is he's a broadcaster, a former broadcaster, producer at BBC Wales. His dad got him a job there, so quite a lot of privilege. Also, the other thing that ties a lot of these, what they call coup plotters together against Jeremy Corbyn, Martin, and people like Owen Smith, is they're all very much pro-European Union. They actually, almost every single one of them is in favour of a second referendum because they don't think we got it right.
Well, Thangham, as we quoted her the other week, she was saying that she feels that because she represents Bristol West, which was very strongly Remain, that she's got to push for a second referendum because that's what her constituency wants. But at the same time, she was saying that the Labour Party's got to reach out to people in places like Kingswood in Gloucestershire, which didn't vote Labour, yes, but they voted for Brexit. I think the left's view on Brexit is we wanted to remain, that's over now, we're going for Brexit. And I come back to my earlier point about Brexit, the right wing of the Labour, the Tory party, wants to go for full exit from the European Union, which means you won't have access to the single market. That's not
sort
what big
of,
business wants.
Is that splendid isolation?
It's a very high-risk strategy.
Not at all. The trade deals are on offer, they're rolling in, and so let's not be negative.
Okay, well, it might work. I'm just saying these are the things that
positive.
Are on
We've
offer.
We've got to be positive. Here it goes.
But the point is that what kind of Brexit it's going to be hasn't been resolved. Now,
Martin,
many people will want
this has been kicked into the long grass this week. Theresa May's now saying, well, we're not going to start the process until next year. Anyway, let's have a quick listen to Jeremy Corbyn, the beginning of his speech, his bid for Labour leader.
Labour is stronger. We've won every parliamentary by-election we've faced, three of them with very significantly increased majorities. We overtook the Tories in the May elections. We won all four of the mayoral contests in Liverpool and Salford, in London for the first time since 2004, and in Bristol for the first time ever.
Well, he does go on to talk about quite a lot more to do with social justice. But Martin, at the end of the... And I'll put links to both of those up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So you're a Jeremy man then, are you, Martin?
Pretty much. I wasn't convinced originally. I was thinking that Andy Burnham might be the person to choose. And I know that Marvin supported Andy Burnham. I think what Marvin has pioneered, which is very good, and Sadiq Khan has picked up on this as well, that it's not the role of a Labour mayor of a major city to take a side in this.
Do you think Marvin has been wise to stay out of this fray in the Labour Party, Claire?
Well, I think, you know, it's very difficult to get a word in edgeways with so much going on. But, you know, Marvin's new to the job and he's very clear about getting on with the job in Bristol, a job that he was elected to do, and he's going to get on with it. And I think all credit to him.
And what's your impression so far?
Well, I think we've got a great cabinet. We're very clear that we're a broad church and we've got lots of different ideas, and that's really healthy, actually, for decision making. We've got a lot on the agenda. We've got a lot of promises that Marvin's made, and, you know, it's all credit to him that he's asking me as a Tory to deliver a Labour manifesto. You know, we're going to get on and do some common sense work.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests. That was Conservative Councillor for Horfield, Cabinet Member for Education and Skills, Claire Hiscott. Let's just hope we get some news now from the Murdoch Newsroom.